Hi, my name is John Mascarenhas. I'm from the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, and today we'll be talking about novel agents and treatment strategies for relapsed refractory myelofibrosis. And the reason why this is an interesting and important and relevant topic to those people in the field, whether they are physicians, NPs, PAs, or other mid-level providers to patients with myelofibrosis, this is a dynamic area of clinical translational research. And in the last decade, we've enjoyed benefit of JAK inhibitors, but one will appreciate from this presentation that there are many other therapies now that are in clinical development, either in combination or in lieu of JAK inhibitors, and the field is really poised to change in significant ways in which the practitioner will need to be aware of, and the impact on patients will be notable. So I hope from this presentation that will come across. And the viewers will come away with a better appreciation of where we've been and where we're going. So I've started off the talk with the NCCN guidelines for the treatment of MF, and I set in both the first and second line option. And of course, the first line option for patients with intermediate or high risk disease by any of the risk scoring systems would be a JAK inhibitor therapy, really geared to addressing spleen and symptom burden. Ruxolitinib, approved since 2011, is usually the first line choice for patients with myelofibrosis in need of treatment. But it is important to realize that fedratinib, now approved in August of 2019 in the US and now recently in the UK, is a second line option, but can also be used frontline with a category 2B recommendation. For those patients who receive JAK inhibitors, it's important to remember that they can induce some degree of on-target myelosuppression, reduction in hemoglobin and platelet count, and that should be explained up front and monitored in an appropriate fashion. But the majority of patients who are treated with these agents do enjoy symptom and spleen benefit and have to be observed for that response, and or lack of response or loss of response. Patients who ultimately lose response or who do never have a optimal response in spleen and symptom benefit really need to be evaluated in dynamic fashion for second line therapies such as fedratinib, listed here, which is a commercially available JAK2 FLT3 inhibitor that can be used second line and is mostly used second line currently in the US to salvage responses, particularly spleen responses in patients who've had previous ruxolitinib treatment. Just to remind the audience, the COMFORT studies were the pivotal studies, the phase 3 studies that led to the approval of ruxolitinib, COMFORT 1 in the US and Canada, COMFORT 2 below in 9 European countries. COMFORT 1 was ruxolitinib versus placebo, and COMFORT 2 was ruxolitinib versus best available therapy. It was quite obvious from these trials that ruxolitinib was superior in terms of spleen volume reduction. 35% is considered the regulatory benchmark for a positive response, which was hit in 42% of patients who received ruxolitinib versus less than 1% in placebo in COMFORT 1. And similarly in COMFORT 2, significant reduction in spleen. And if you look at the waterfall plots below, which I think are even more meaningful, there's a spectrum of responses that even occur in most patients, even 10% or greater is thought to be clinically relevant. Whereas if you look at the patients who got placebo or best available therapy, most of those patients had worsening of their spleen volume, which is an indication of the natural history of the disease. Symptoms were also greatly improved, shown here, and I show you the waterfall plots. Patients enjoyed usually rapid improvement in their symptoms, and no matter what type of symptom burden you looked at, and orange indicates those patients in COMFORT 1 who got ruxolitinib, going below the line indicates a reduction or an improvement in symptom burden. This was seen across each symptom type with ruxolitinib treatment and not seen with placebo. And that symptom burden was both rapid and durable, as shown in the graph below. Now, what was very interesting and sort of unexpected, we did not see bone marrow histopathologic responses or complete molecular responses with ruxolitinib, but we did see, and this is a 5-year data of pooled analysis of COMFORT study, survival benefits. So if you look at the green line, those are patients who received ruxolitinib up front. The median survival is approximately 5 years in those patients, where the patients who are in the blue line, who received either BAT or placebo and crossed over, the median survival is approximately 3.84 years. The dotted line is an interesting line. It's a model, a statistical model that would suggest those patients who received the control arms, and if they were to exist and continue on those control arms and were modeled based on their initial response and survival, that is a rank-preserving structural failure test model that shows what those patients would look like if they were existed in terms of survival, and that's about 2.4 years. So it's compelling evidence that despite the absence of molecular and pathologic remission, there is a survival benefit of early use of ruxolitinib, which we believe is mediated by improvements in symptom burden and reversal of cachexia and performance status rather than anticlonal deletion. So fedratinib is the second JAK inhibitor approved, and it's actually been in clinical development for quite some time. It took some time to get it approved. And I show you here the Jakarta 2 study because that may be the most pivotal study. The Jakarta study, the original study was randomized phase three study comparing to ruxolitinib in patients who are JAK inhibitor naive. This is patients who've seen at least 14 days of ruxolitinib previously and received fedratinib in a single-arm phase 2 open-label study at 400 milligrams daily. And what this study showed very nicely in this patient population that was both refractory and resistant or intolerant to ruxolitinib is a 30% improvement in spleen volume and a 30% improvement in symptom response. So despite quote-unquote failure of first-line JAK inhibitor therapy, fedratinib afforded a third of the patients that benchmark response. But again, if you look at the waterfall plots below, one can appreciate in an intention-to-treat rigorous analysis that the majority of patients treated with fedratinib enjoyed some degree of spleen volume response. So this is a meaningful second-line agent, clearly, for patients with ruxolitinib failure that's commercially available. So fedratinib has also been explored, and I think this slide is important because platelets matter. Low platelets factor into risk scoring. They also limit the ability to effectively give JAK inhibitors. The label for ruxolitinib is greater than 50,000. Similarly, for fedratinib, the label is greater than 50,000. And what the analysis here shows that you can effectively give fedratinib at 400 milligrams daily to patients with platelet counts of 50 to 100,000 without dose reduction, which would in theory, reduce the efficacy of the drug or attenuate the efficacy, and you still get spleen volume responses that exceed 30%, as well as spleen symptom responses. So highly effective at similar doses in patients with platelet counts of 50 to 100,000 without the need for dose reduction. Now, it's important to note the other JAK inhibitors that are very far and advanced in clinical development, like momelotinib. This is a JAK1-2 ACVR1 inhibitor. Here I'm showing you the two pivotal studies, SIMPLIFY-1 and SIMPLIFY-2. SIMPLIFY-1 was momelotinib versus ruxolitinib in those that are JAK inhibitor naive. And SIMPLIFY-2 were those patients who had Rux exposure and then got randomized to momelotinib or best available therapy, in which ruxolitinib could be used as well. What I want to skip to is the fact that momelotinib has a potentially a distinction amongst the other JAK inhibitors as it inhibits activin A receptor type 1, which mediates SMAD signaling and then eventually hepcidin expression, which may affect iron metabolism and distribution and can affect erythropoiesis in a meaningful way. And this may underlie the reason why in the early phase studies, there was a clear improvement in anemia and reduction in transfusion dependence that was durable, that is quite distinct from ruxolitinib and fedratinib, in which there's on-target and essentially expected anemia and thrombocytopenia. And most recently at ASH, Serge Verstovic and colleagues looked at the SIMPLIFY-2 study. So this was after ruxolitinib exposure. And if you look at the patients who received momelotinib in blue, the transfusion independence rate, those that were converted from dependent to independent, was 43% compared to 21% in those patients who received best available therapy. And that translated to a durable transfusion independence-free survival, as shown on the graph on the right. So and a distinction of this JAK inhibitor amongst the other JAK inhibitors. And for this reason, the MOMENTUM study is an important study to keep in mind and refer patients to if appropriate. These are patients who have previously been treated with ruxolitinib and have symptom and spleen burden and anemia. They're randomized to momelotinib versus danazol, which has an anemia response rate of about 30% in most studies. The primary endpoint of this study is a total symptom score improvement, but the key secondary endpoints are spleen volume response and and transfusion independence anemia response. So we look forward to this study because this could add a drug that could provide JAK inhibition benefits, but also with effects on anemia. Which leads us to pacineb, which has been evaluated in the PERSIST studies. And I'm showing you here a composite of PERSIST 1 and PERSIST 2. These were randomized phase 3 studies comparing pacritinib, which is a selective JAK2 FLT3 IRAK1 inhibitor, particularly in patients with low platelets. It was learned early on in the development of this drug seemed to be less myelosuppressive than the other inhibitors and could be delivered effectively in patients with an unmet need. Those are patients with less than 50,000, which the current JAK inhibitors exclude. And you can see here from this analysis, the SVR rate was approximately 30%. So this is an outstanding finding that allows patients with low platelets that would normally be discriminated against due to their platelet count and the on-target thrombocytopenia of other JAK inhibitors to enjoy spleen benefit on top and even symptom benefit below. This ultimately led to the PACIFICA study, which is an ongoing randomized phase 3 study in low platelets, exclusively patients with less than 50,000 who have spleen and symptom burden, who have less than 90 days of prior JAK inhibitor. They randomized 2-to-1 to pacritinib and then best available or physician's choice with a primary endpoint of SVR and a key secondary endpoint of symptom improvement. So here is my slide I've shown multiple times at talks. I have an envision in a perfect world where there were multiple agents involved. One can see in the second line on the right, if you fail ruxolitinib and low platelets, pacritinib could meet that need. For those that have profound progressive splenomegaly, fedratinib is likely a great option. And then for those patients that have significant anemia and transfusion independence that's driving the disease burden, momelotinib would be a great option. Now, there are many drugs, and this is where the remaining part of this talk, that are in clinical investigation, either as add-on strategies to JAK inhibitors to improve upon them in suboptimal or failure situations, and or drugs that can be used with differing mechanism of action after JAK inhibitor failure. So here's a summary slide looking at the novel non-JAK inhibitor therapies that are in development in MF. And what I try to do is break it down into groups, epigenetics on the left. I've highlighted the ones that we will quickly mention in today's talk. CPI-0610 is an oral pan-BET inhibitor, very interesting drug that has relevance and preclinical data in this setting, as well as down below those that affect the apoptotic pathway mechanisms like imetelstat, the telomerase inhibitor, navitoclax, the BCL2, BCLX inhibitor. And then on the right, we are very aware that the tumor microenvironment supports the malignant stem cell population. And drugs that can target, for example, TGF-beta or P-selectin can be very effective here. And these are still in early clinical development. Immune deregulation is a hallmark of myelofibrosis, but actually immune targeting agents are still in its infancy. We have data on pembrolizumab that we are on the verge of publishing that would suggest that it's an inactive drug alone, but that the correlative data would suggest that there are clear changes in the immune repertoire of patients treated with pembrolizumab that would suggest that it may be a great combinatorial partner. And of course, recently, a calreticulin vaccine trial was published, although negative results suggest that this is an avenue that should be pursued more intensely. And then lastly, signaling pathway inhibitors that could complement the JAK inhibition, such as the PI3 kinase inhibition. So CPI-0610, these are one of the few that I'll highlight because I think they're important and they have the potential for paradigm shifts in this field, is a pan-BET inhibitor. And this is the MANIFEST-2 study. And BET proteins are important epigenetic proteins. They are considered reader proteins and they facilitate gene transcription in the context of the epigenome. And it is known that BET proteins, particularly BRD4, as there are a number of these BET proteins, regulate transcription of NF-kappa B target genes that are important for inflammation, extramedullary hematopoiesis, and regulate factors that mediate bone marrow fibrosis, and may also play an important role in aberrant erythroid and megakaryocyte differentiation. And this has been shown in preclinical modeling. Therefore, drugs that could block this, like CPI-0610, could have ameliorating effects on all these aspects that are meaningful to myelofibrosis. So for that reason, we took this drug into the phase 2 setting, the MANIFEST study. Today, I'm just going to concentrate on, there are three cohorts. I'm going to concentrate on the cohort up on top, which is the monotherapy cohort. This is patients who had failed ruxolitinib and got CPI's monotherapy at 125 milligrams, 2 weeks on, 1 week off. And we're stratified by those patients who were transfusion dependent. The endpoint would be conversion to transfusion independence. And those patients who had big spleens and SVR would be the endpoint. Other cohorts that were included in the study were those that were add-on strategies to patients who were having a suboptimal response to ruxolitinib. And then for those patients ultimately who had never seen a JAK inhibitor, we're using this drug, CPI-0610, now known as palbociclib, in combination with ruxolitinib upfront. Very paradigm shifting, as ruxolitinib has really been the mainstay as monotherapy for over a decade. What do we see with CPI-0610 as monotherapy? First of all, 21% of patients that were transfusion dependent converted to transfusion independence. 57% of those patients had at least a 30% reduction in transfusion intensity. And the mean duration of transfusion independence was approximately 32 weeks. So there was a clear signal of anemia response with this single agent after ruxolitinib failure. And in those patients where spleen was the major treating factor, and I'm showing you here color-coded by whether they were transfusion-dependent in green or non-transfusion-dependent, where spleen was the major issue, there was significant reduction in spleen volume with 30%, SVR 35%. You'll remember, if you look back at the slides, that's comparable to what fedratinib showed in second line in the Jakarta 2 study. So effective in these patients for spleen volume reduction, effective in the transfusion dependent patients in anemia improvement. We also improved symptom, and this was dramatic. I treated many of these patients with single agent. The symptom improvement was rapid within the first week and was durable. And approximately 50% of patients who had non-transfusion dependence, so really spleen and symptom hyperproliferative disease, really benefited from this drug in terms of symptom benefit after Rux failure. Interestingly and importantly, there was evidence of disease modification with palbociclib, in which 21% of patients with monotherapy had at least one grade reduction in bone marrow fibrosis, and this happened in a relatively short period of time. You typically don't see this with single agent ruxolitinib. And most importantly, well-tolerated drug. You can see there were no grade 4 events. And the grade 3 events, particularly the thrombocytopenia and anemia, were relatively infrequent, 15 and 13%. And this is favorable compared to most drugs that we use, including JAK inhibitors like ruxolitinib in this setting. There is on-target GI toxicity, which is very manageable in the first cycle, and was very rarely a reason for discontinuation. Now, moving on to BCL2, BCL-XL inhibition, Ron Hoffman's lab over a decade ago showed that the BCL2, BCL-XL is upregulated in PV, but also MF samples, and that blocking this with a BCL2, BCL-XL inhibitor that was originally in development, ABT-737, significantly led to selective reduction in MPN CD34 cells. And this was actually even more impressive in combination with drugs like interferon, and the rationale is that JAK-STAT signaling leads to upregulation of these pro-survival proteins, and then inhibiting this would lead to apoptosis. So this led to the phase 2 study of navitoclax in combination with ruxolitinib in patients with primary or secondary myelofibrosis. So this study is an add-on strategy to patients who are on Rux, who have residual spleen and symptom benefit. And what you can see is 30% of patients achieved an SVR 35% with the add-on of navitoclax, and approximately 30% also had a symptom improvement. So improving upon ruxolitinib by combining it to ruxolitinib in the select patient population. And there was a sense that there was disease modification with 50% of patients having at least a 10% reduction in JAK2 or CALR VAF levels, and about a third of the patients, again, having reduction in bone marrow fibrosis. This drug does induce on-target thrombocytopenia by inhibiting BCL-XL, so that causes some degree of need for dose modification and more attention, but seemed to be mostly manageable in this clinical trial. I should mention that both the palbociclib and the navitoclax studies have moved on now to the phase 3 setting, both upfront In the case of palibresib, with ruxolitinib and JAK inhibitor naive patients, that's the MANIFEST 2 study. And then the studies with navitoclax are in both upfront and in second line, those patients with a suboptimal response. Lastly, I'll talk about telomerase. This is an enzyme that's constitutively actively expressed in MPN hematopoietic stem cells and only transiently in normal stem cells. It's important for adding repeats, what are called telomere repeats, the ends of chromosomes, which are lost upon cell division. Cells get to a certain critical point where they undergo senescence and ultimately apoptosis. And this drug inhibits that enzyme and therefore removes that advantage that malignant stem cells have for immortality by adding these important telomere repeats. And it binds to the RNA template and is a very potent competitive inhibitor that's given as an intravenous infusion and was taken into the clinic in a large multicenter phase 2 study. And I should mention that original pilot study was done by Ayala Teferi, published in New England Journal of Medicine, that showed that there was a signal of activity, a rapid signal of activity of not only spleen and symptom, but of pathologic responses and molecular responses in patients with this disease. And we tested this at two doses, 9.4 milligrams per kilogram every 3 weeks, and a lower dose of 4.7 milligrams per kilogram every 2 weeks. It was the 9.4 milligrams that was the active dose. 10% of patients had SVR 35%, 30% had a 50% response rate from a symptom score. These were patients who had previously failed ruxolitinib. But what was most impressive, and I've circled in red, is the median survival of approximately 30 months. And what I did not mention previously, patients who fail ruxolitinib, and the median time to discontinuation is approximately 3 years, patients who fail ruxolitinib have a median survival shown in multiple studies of approximately 1 to 1.5 years. So increasing this to 30 months would be significant. We showed that this improvement in disease aspects was not by chance. And here we show on the left that there was a dose-dependent pharmacodynamic effect in reducing telomerase activity in hTERT RNA expression levels, a readout of telomerase inhibition. And this was true with exposure. So irrespective of the dose, the higher the exposure, the more likely you were to get the intended optimal pharmacodynamic effect. And if you look at the graph on the right, on the top at 9.4 milligrams per kilogram IV, the effective dose, there was a sense that those patients with a shorter telomere were more likely to benefit from a survival benefit, which lends itself to the telomere biology understanding. At the bottom, I show that the optimal pharmacodynamic effect of hTERT RNA expression level or telomerase activity reduction was enriched in those patients who had spleen and symptom benefit, and on the right, survival benefit. So linking dose, exposure, telomere length at baseline, and pharmacodynamic effect with meaningful clinical outputs of spleen, symptom, and most importantly, survival. And that's led to the pivotal IMPACT study, IMPACT MF study shown here, patients who have refractory MF to ruxolitinib, and they are randomized to imetelstat in a 2-to-1 fashion to best available therapy with a overall survival endpoint, which is really quite different. Most of the endpoints to date have been spleen and more recently symptom. But here we're looking at trying to actually improve survival in patients where we know the survival is quite limited and the options are limited. So in conclusion, second-line options after ruxolitinib failure include fedratinib and JAK inhibitor-based combination salvage therapy approaches, but those are all experimental at this point. Novel non-JAK inhibitor therapeutics may offer additional clinical benefit for those patients who have discontinued RUX. And I showed you examples of CPI-0610, but I didn't show you bomedemstat, which is another epigenetic therapy, which is an LSD1 inhibitor, which is earlier on in development. But there are many similar drugs in this epigenetic class that one must keep an eye on. And then drugs like navitoclax that induce the apoptosis pathway, again, that have preclinical rationale, really have an opportunity to improve upon, for example, suboptimal responses to ruxolitinib. And then ultimately, drugs that can try to delete and target the MPN
hematopoietic stem cell, such as imetelstat, which is a telomerase inhibitor, are very exciting with the prospect of improving survival in these patients and potentially even as a bridge to transplant. So these rational agents really appear to provide early signals of clinical benefit. I hope I've provided that data to convince you of that. But they ultimately needed to be, you know, approved in a phase 3 study, which is what is ongoing in many cases. And I would encourage any of the listeners who are seeing patients with myelofibrosis as a rare disease, if they have the opportunity to enroll these patients in trials or refer them to tertiary centers where these trials exist, it is very important to get this information to try to move the field forward. And with that, I want to thank the audience for listening to this this topic, and I hope I've convinced you that we've come a long way in the treatment of myelofibrosis, and we're making strides, and I think the next 3 to 5 years we'll see significant changes, and dare I say even the additions of agents to the commercial space to help our patients with myelofibrosis. Thanks for listening.